Today on the show, we are talking about how to build trust on teams and what are the signs that your team might have trust issues. And I'm joined by my very favourite work bestie, Shane Hatton. Welcome back.
I have trust issues. So
I asked you especially for this reason.
When you were saying the introduction to the show and you were saying trust issues, I was like, okay, now I know why you've got me on the show for today.
You flew out from London specifically for this episode on trust issues.
I was expecting to get here and just find an empty studio to really reinforce those trust issues.
And be like, total stitch up. So, well, yeah, you said it. Trust issues. That is the name of the episode. Enough. We did say before this, we'd get
it's
the giggles.
Because we never normally record in person. And this is the first time, I mean, other than the very, very first time we recorded together in Newcastle, this is the first time we've been back recording live together.
It's amazing. So let's jump straight in. This is a podcast about making work work. You'll learn about leadership, career growth, and how to navigate those weird work challenges. I run a HR consulting business called Boldside, where I help leaders build epic team cultures. If you lead a team or run a business and you think I can help, let's connect on LinkedIn. My name is Shelley Johnson, and this is Work.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
We want to talk about this thing of trust issues on teams because I think it's really important and it feeds into so many of the behaviours that we see at work. Mm. And I want to know from your perspective, I've got a couple of ideas, but I'd love to hear yours around what are some of the signs that your team has trust issues?
Yeah, good topic because when we did our research for my book, Let's Talk Culture, we looked at what are some of the big culture builders and what are the culture killers. And the number one thing that came up that said this is a culture killer is a lack of trust. So trusting relationships came out in the top five, but the number one culture killer was a lack of trust. It was something like 60% of people said, you know, a lack of trust was a sign of an unhealthy culture. So good topic to talk about. But I mean, there's heaps of things that could actually reveal a lack of trust. I'll give you a couple. I'm sure you got a few that come to mind. I was having a conversation with a mutual friend of ours, Alicia Mackay, and she had this idea, which I really loved, that I've always kind of stolen and pretended it's my own. Is that she said, you can tell there's a lack of trust when a team has more than one meeting. Now, not as in more than one meeting a week, but she says for every meeting you have, there's the meeting before the meeting, then there's the meeting, and then there's a meeting after the meeting. So because people don't feel comfortable to be able to talk about what they really want to talk about in the actual meeting, they get together before and they build alliances, they get in the meeting, they kind of secretly text each other during the meeting, then afterwards they get together and go, could you believe? And they debrief what was taking place after that. I reckon that's a pretty big sign that there's a potentially some eroding trust within a team.
I love that. It reminds me of Survivor.
It does.
Like the building alliances and like two people walking down the beach, like trying to form their alliances together. And then they go in and then they just totally derail it in the voting
And someone's
voting
like
ceremony.
Voted out and all of a sudden someone's name's read out and you're like, what? And all these people are like huddling together. It feels like corporate Survivor. You know, when a team is lacking trust, it feels like corporate Survivor. You're sitting there going, what is going on? Like, I never saw any of this coming. It kind of leads into the second idea that I think you see a lot when teams are lacking trust, which is this evidence gathering culture that starts to emerge. It's one of those things, I don't know if you've ever been in a relationship where you start to create, like, you get into that place where you start creating tallies. It's like, well, you did this, but I did that, so you did that. Okay, we'll just, like, see who balances out and even. So what you start to do is you accumulate evidence because you know at some point that evidence is going to come in handy for you. And you see it in teams where they haven't got a lot of safety or trust that people almost create this evidence checklist of, like, okay, if something really comes out, I'm going to use this against that person. And I think that's a pretty big sign that you're not heading down a pathway of trust.
I also think that idea of keeping score,
yeah,
like having a scorecard. And I know in Adam Grant's book, Give or Take, he talks about that idea of like a person who's a matcher. So like with every kind of thing that someone else does, they have to match it in terms of like generosity. So this morning you shouted me breakfast. So if I'm a matcher, I'm keeping score of that going, next time Shane's in Australia, I'm going to have to make sure that I shout him to match the generosity. And I think it goes both ways, because it can be keeping score of issues and using that as an evidence base against someone, or keeping score of the good things and feeling like generosity doesn't fly here. Mm. It has to be matched, and we all have to like meet this kind of threshold or level of like, you know, evening each other's gifts or generosity out.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a really good book by Stephen Covey called The Speed of Trust. And I think in the title illustrates one of the big ideas: when teams don't have trust, they don't have speed, which is that things, I don't know if you found this working in teams in the past, where if you don't feel like there's that high trust environment, you can't move as quickly as you would as if you had a really high trust environment. You look at it, and I don't like to use the example of team sports, but if you are, you're in the middle of this kind of high adrenaline, fast-paced environment, and you're somewhere, look, I'm not a sports person, so I'm going to use the best of my attempt to try and make sense of this. But if you're in the middle of the field and there's a person on the wing and you don't trust that person, you're less likely to pass them the ball, and you miss opportunities in the heat of the moment because there's not that ability to be able to rely on the people around you. So you lose a sense of that speed, you lose potential opportunities. But one thing Stephen Covey says in the book that I really love is he said, we often judge other people on their behaviors, but ourselves by our intentions. So we judge our own intentions, but other people's behaviors. Mm-hmm. And so often when someone will say something, we misinterpret their intention in a low trust environment. And he says, in high trust environments, even if the wrong thing is said, we understand the correct meaning. And I really love that kind of concept around trust.
That idea of assumptions to me would be one of my signs that there's low trust. Yeah. When we default to negative assumptions about people. So like in that exact example where we judge ourselves by our own intentions, but others by their behavior, I think it taking that idea even further and going, not just judging someone's behavior in and of itself, but judging the intent behind that really harshly. So I was talking with a manager the other day, and employee had an issue where they'd called in sick, and that manager's first assumption was, well, they must be lying.
Yeah.
So my question back to them was, how do you know that they're lying? Mm. And like, well, I just know. And I'm like, yeah, but how? Like, tell me more about that. Mm. And kind of digging into the assumption to go, can you know that that's true?
Yeah.
And eventually we get to, well, no, we can't know for certain that that's true. And I'm like, so what gives you the assumption of that? And they're like, well, other behavior. I'm like, okay, well, let's just unpick this for a sec. Because that assumption and negative assumptions about people show a lack of trust. Yeah. And there might be good reason for making assumptions, but I think in most cases, assumptions tend to move us towards like less than ideal leadership behavior or less than ideal cultural behavior on a team. And so the only assumptions I think leaders and teams should make are assuming good intent.
Yeah.
Like that would be the only assumption I think is like recommended in most cases. Like if you go into a situation where you're like, hey, this thing's happened on our team. This person said this thing about me. What would be the good intent behind that? Mm. And how do we have that as a lens? Because I think that's a high trust kind of culture. But when we're in a culture where there isn't that much trust, you tend to see that negativity and cynicism come out in how people perceive the behavior.
Yeah. And how people respond to that generally will either build trust or erode trust in the process of that. So if we look at the media as an example, often what the media want are statements. Whenever something happens, what they want is a statement, because they want to try and nail a person down based on a statement. But what is most helpful is a story. It's the context, it's the information, it's the background, it's the, you know, some of the intentions behind that. And you see it a lot more. We want things short, sharp, and we want to make a lot of assumptions or judgments without fully understanding context and information. So when you see a team that has this eroding trust, often they will hear a statement and then make an assumption or a judgment, but never probe further to understand context or hear story. And that's, I think, in healthy teams where you see high trust environments, someone will say something and maybe it could be interpreted the wrong way. And rather than listening to a statement or making a judgment, you go, hey, can you tell me a bit more about, you know, when you said that, can you tell me a bit more about that? Mm. Or, hey, that sounds a little bit off for you. Can you maybe give me a bit more of the context about what you meant? And then allowing to kind of probe a bit deeper. And I think on the flip side of that as well, one of the things you see is when you are in a high trust environment, other people can speak well on your behalf. So for example, if you go into a meeting and you cut someone's legs out under an idea and you leave the meeting, in low trust environments, everyone will talk about how, you know, how much of a bad person you are, how horrible a person you are. Whereas in a high trust environment, if it seems out of character, people will say, that seemed out of character. Maybe we should talk to them and I have a conversation with them. And you can see the difference in assuming positive intent versus going straight to statement and judgment.
Yeah, the judgment word is so massive because I think judgment happens so much quicker than we ever want. And I think about how many times you make a judgment call without having all the information and how many times I've made a wrong judgment. And like those two things, like the speed with which we make a judgment call and an assumption about someone that tends to be negative versus the speed with which we make a positive assumption about someone, they're very different things. And I think if you're in a healthy team, I love that idea that no one talks about you in a negative way when you're not around. Mm. I think one of the other signs of trust issues and a really obvious sign, which I think is on every team, is gossip. Mm. And I think we think about gossip as like this thing that happens when you see people, I don't know, at the hairdresser talking about the latest person's affair or some kind of like drama-fueled kind of conversation. But I think gossip is less about that and more about talking about someone instead of to someone. Mm. So if I've got an issue with you, Shane, which I never would have that.
Why would you? I'm a perfect human being.
But if I've got an issue with you, instead of talking to you about it, I talk to this person on the team and this, that person. And I just, I say that it's debriefing.
Yeah.
But really it's gossip.
Yeah.
And I think that is a real common challenge I see on so many teams all around Australia, that people build this habit of disguising gossip as debriefing. Mm. And to me, that becomes such an ingrained pattern of behaviour. Mm. And I think to shift it, it's like, how do we have a culture where we talk to the person instead of about the person?
Yeah. Yeah, tough. Because I think people would argue that they say, well, who am I going to talk to about this if I don't feel comfortable or safe to be able to talk to the person? In which case, we would disguise it as debriefing with the person. Which I think in cases is okay. The problem is when you start to debrief with five people. Do you know what I mean? Like people go, oh no, I was just debriefing with our friendship group, or I was just debriefing with this person, but I also wanted to debrief with that person. I also wanted to debrief with this person. And you're like, well, who's really getting the value out of this? Like it, you're kind of, you say it's debriefing, but really it's probably a bit more gossipy than it is anything else. And I think in this context, I love that phrase, we talk to and not about, which is just a beautiful reflection of high trust environments, which is, hey, do I actually feel safe enough to have a conversation directly with this person? And if not, is look at, I always say that when you go, when a person on your team comes to you as a leader, one of the conversations I'll have with somebody is this a problem or is this a complaint? And if it's a problem, it has an outcome or a solution. And if it's a complaint, it often doesn't. And so I'd say more often than not, gossip doesn't tend to have an outcome other than to potentially talk about somebody else, pull somebody else down, reveal something about somebody else. It tends to not serve any real purpose for the person that delivers the gossip. But if you bring it to your manager and say, hey, I want to, can we have a conversation about this? Then usually there's some kind of core outcome. And maybe that outcome is just purely that a person says, I don't feel safe to talk about it to a person and I just need to sense check my ideas. That's at least an outcome.
Yeah.
But more often than not, gossip doesn't have an outcome other than to hurt other people. So I think, again, being really clear, the debrief versus the gossip is an outcome.
Yeah. And I love that distinction of digging into, is it that you don't feel safe to talk to the person? And there'll be heaps of cases where you're in a work environment where, unfortunately, you don't feel like you can go directly to the person because there isn't that trust or psychological safety, which we're going to get to in a sec. But I think to your point, if we think about, okay, what is the action that I want? Mm. What is the change that I want? Which will then shape how you have that conversation with your manager to go, okay, the action that I want is simply to sense check if I've read this right. Mm. Because that might be one action. Then you go, okay, I'm just sense checking. Or I want to sense check my assumption here because I'm making an assumption and I may maybe like way off.
Yep.
Or an action might be, hey, Shane, if you're my manager, I would come to you and say, hey, Shane, like I've got this issue with this person. I noticed this in a meeting. What would you recommend I do?
Yeah.
And simply getting advice could be the action. But if it's constant debriefing that goes round and round, it's like the merry-go-round that never has any change or result, as you say, that's where we start to go, okay, this is a habit or cultural behaviour and it's not helping us.
Yep.
It's undermining and eroding trust every time this happens because every other person walks away from that conversation and goes, Shelley is saying about me when I'm not around.
Mm. Have you ever, I find that with people as well. Like if you talk to somebody who is regularly talking about somebody else, everything about that in my instinctive nature says, what do they say about me when I'm not in the room?
Mm.
So gossip doesn't just make another person look bad. It makes you as the person who's delivering that look bad, and as a person who's not trustworthy. And so if this is a whole conversation about how do I build trusting relationships on a team, well, don't be the person who becomes known for talking about everybody else all the time, because the chances are good that nobody's going to want to talk to you. And I think a leader plays a really big part in that. I think gossip is not just as much about the person who shares as much as it is about the person who listens and who gives airtime to that. So you can be a leader in a position where you go, this sounds like it's more of a gossip conversation than it is a goal-oriented, actionable, outcome-based conversation or a genuine, authentic debrief sense check conversation. But you let it go on because it's interesting or you're curious or you get to know things about someone, and you play just as important a role by not shutting it down as the person is who's bringing it up and having that conversation.
So let's talk about how you build trust on teams, because I think one other sign that I would see where there are trust issues is that people are afraid to fail.
Mm.
And like this idea of, I can't fail here because it's not safe.
Yeah.
And it's not a place where failure is seen as like a learning opportunity. It's seen as failure means that you're not good enough.
Yeah.
Or you don't measure up. I think those kind of signs that we've just described of like gossip, of making assumptions, of judgment, of the meeting after the meeting, all those things to me point to, okay, well, we've got trust issues. So if someone's listening right now and they're thinking, okay, I'm ticking some of those boxes, and most of us will, because like teams, like any relationship, have trust dynamics. Like you think about every relationship in your life will have some of these dynamics that you need to constantly work on. So if you're listening, you're like, okay, I'm ticking the boxes. What do I do? How do I build trust? I'd love to know, what do you think are some of the, like, okay. Are there quick wins?
Yeah. Can I build trust quickly?
How can
and
we
And how
hack?
Can I build it overnight?
I always think like, how can we hack trust? Like, can we hack it? Like, are there like some kind of like magical things that someone comes over and they're like, fix all the trust problems? And I feel like the answer is no, but tell me, what do you think are some of the ways we can build trust?
Okay, so I did some research in the book for this to try and understand, okay, what are the ways that we build trust? And what I would say is I think trust is credibility over time, unfortunately, which is the idea that you have to, there has to be a consistent alignment between your words and actions, which is ultimately what credibility is all about. But it has to be credibility demonstrated over time to enable trust to take place. But there is a certain degree, and I think that the kind of key important message in this is it's not trust or no trust. It's I would almost say that there are levels of trust. I mean, I trust you more than I trust other people, but you know, there are certain things that I trust you to do that I potentially other things I wouldn't trust you to do, right? Like if I was abseiling and you were holding the rope, like I trust you as a friend, but I have certain degrees of trust when it comes to certain things. So I want to know, I mean, I don't know, maybe you've got this huge demonstrated career in rock climbing that I don't know about, but I mean, do you?
I know.
Okay, good. I was just clarifying. Otherwise, it's a horrible example, right? So I can trust you for certain things, but not necessarily other things. I want to see credibility over time to give more trust than potentially low trust. But one of the things that was interesting about the research is less than one in four managers, and there was a study done by the Workforce Institute. They studied 4,000 managers, and they basically found that less than one in four managers actually give trust to their employees on day one. They believe that trust has to be earned. Which I think is a challenge, because basically you bring people into the organization, you trust them enough to hire them, but then I don't trust you enough on day one until you earn it. And you've almost all of a sudden now got to earn it over time. So I think there has to be a base level of trust that's given to me, almost like a default or like a default level of trust that obviously we can build upon and strengthen that trust through credibility over time, or potentially we could erode trust over time by a lack of credibility over time. But more often than not, I don't know, do you see this challenge? I just think, I believe that people should be given a base level of trust in most kind of contexts.
I remember a CEO I worked for talked about this idea of start with trust.
Yeah.
So like give trust to people from the get-go. So as a leader, if you extend trust to people from the get-go, and see how much more they thrive in that environment, as opposed to starting from a place of, until you reach XYZ standard, I will not be able to fully trust you. And then you have the next benchmark that you need to meet. Mm. And I think that that model of starting from a place of trust, and then when they're, and expect that there'll be things that come up that go, oops, that was weird. Like, we probably need to fix that, or we probably need to work on that. I think it's a much more optimistic way to view people, and it sets an environment that people rise to. Yeah. I feel like they rise to the level of trust that you extend. But if you set a controlling environment where you don't give people trust from the get-go, people then like stay in that kind of like box that you put them in until you say, well, now you've ticked that. And I think it's like, I just think it's not a super positive way to kind of lead. Like, and I say that knowing that people do the weirdest stuff, and we all have moments where we break trust with people. I think that's just part of life. But it, to me, it's more about how you repair those and fix those that ends up being a really important part of trust building. For me, as you were talking about the credibility over time, which I love, even though I think, oh, over time.
We can hack that.
Like, put it into sprints and we do it in 8-week cycles.
We'll do a 90-day sprint. We're going to hack trust in our team. Okay, 90 days, we're going to turn this thing around.
Agile trust. That's what we do. I think I was reminded of when I went skydiving. So I went skydiving at 21. Like, my best friend, Emma, she bought me a skydiving ticket for my birthday. I was like, the worst.
Is she really your best friend?
She's a terrible friend.
Are you still friends?
She broke trust.
Okay, good.
So she buys me this ticket. Like, I'm like, why would you do that? That's the worst present ever. And I'm not a heights person. So I like went and did, I went and did the skydiving thing. We were up in the plane. It was over like Wollongong, over the beach. It was beautiful. And I'm sitting there with this guy like strapped to my back. I don't know. I don't know. That's how you describe it.
Well, I would say that you were probably strapped to him rather than this guy strapped to your back, as though like you have full autonomy in this moment.
So I'm in the plane. We're about to jump out of this plane. And I feel like it's the ultimate trust exercise, because I'm like, okay, listen, mate. How do I know you're trustworthy? And so I was like to him, okay, how many times have you done this? Mm. And he's like, oh, this is probably my third time. I was like, excuse me? Like, sorry, what?
Wait, is that what he said?
That's what he said to me in the plane as we're about, like, people are already jumping out. I'm like, wait, what? And I was like, freak out. Like, I can even feel like I always like freaking out. I'm like, hey, what do you mean? And he's like, yeah, this is like my third time. Like, I'm relatively new, but it's going to be fine. And I was like, okay, I'm having a freak out. I'm like so terrified. Anyway, turns out he was lying. It wasn't his third jump. Like, he jumped like obviously stacks of times. So I didn't realize that. But it did make me feel like when you think about trust, it's trust over time, but it's also repeated instances and the power of repetition. So I was thinking for this guy, if he'd only jumped out three times, I'm like, you do not have enough of a track record. Yeah. But for someone who, if they've repeatedly done that and demonstrated the skill, then I extend trust even in the most dire life and death situations.
Yeah.
And so I kind of feel like the combination when we think about trust, it's credibility over time, but also the small habits that are repeated. Yep. And if you repeatedly show up, here's an example that I think leaders do all the time. When they repeatedly show up late for one-on-ones, like, that's small. It's not big, but that detracts from trust every single time. When you're repeatedly late, or you repeatedly check your phone in one-on-ones and like over time detracts from trust.
Yeah.
So for me, well, I look at, okay, well, what could you do to counteract that? And it's the repetition of good habits.
Yeah.
Of, okay, I'm going to prioritize these one-on-one meetings and be on time every time.
Yeah.
Or if I can't, for whatever reason, I let someone know in advance. Mm. But how do we have the repeated behavior that builds trust? And I feel like, Shane, it's all the small things.
Yeah.
Like, I know you just went to blink.
Yeah, I know. Sorry, my head disappeared into a song right then, but it's fine. It is all the small things.
It's like the small things that we repeat that build trust. And once we did that skydiving thing, the guy, I get to the bottom and I was like, that was the worst thing you could possibly say to anyone jumping out of a plane. But I think that's the, to me, repetition of good habits.
Yeah.
And then to your point, over time, that's how you build trust.
Super important. And this is the thing, right? So if your skydiving instructor had said to you, oh, by the way, my last tandem person, I forgot to strap in properly and they fell to their death. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't matter the repetition that they've had. You immediately lose trust, right?
Yes.
So this is the problem, right? So repetition over time, it's a horrible example. It's very morbid for us to even talk about. But repetition over time, this is the fragility of trust, right? Is that you could spend an entire lifetime building trust and one decision can erode that trust. Now, does that person deserve to be held accountable for those decisions? Absolutely. Can a person rebuild trust after that? Absolutely they can. But is it going to take a lot of time and intentionality to build that? Absolutely. And so this is why when we talk about building trust in a team, it's not saying you can never break people's trust. It's saying you have to be so conscious of when you do about repairing those relationships. And, you know, we've got a mutual friend, Rowan Dredge, who I think he was the first one I heard talk about this. He was saying, if you break trust in a context, you have to be conscious about repairing that trust within the same context. So you might go into a team meeting and you shut down somebody and you're quite rude about it, and that erodes your trust. You then take that person aside and you say, hey, sorry, I was pretty rude to you in that last meeting. I had a bad day and had a bad meeting. Are we okay? And they're like, yeah, of course. I totally understand that. And you repair trust with that person, but you've lost trust with your team. Mm. And so you have to go back to the next meeting, even though you've repaired that relationship, and go back to the same context and say, hey, everyone, I just wanted to acknowledge in that last meeting, I wasn't very kind to Shelley. And that's not the kind of leader that I want to be. And so I think you can repair trust, but you then have to follow that through with behaviors that actually demonstrate that you've learned from that mistake. And that one mistake can just be a moment in time as opposed to a set of repeated behaviors over time.
Yeah, and I think it goes to the point of some trust areas are higher stakes than others.
Yeah, hugely.
Because of like the scale and the size. Yeah. So let's say you're in a meeting and there's 30 people there, and that happens where you make an off-the-cuff remark and it goes down like a lead balloon.
Yeah.
And you realize, crap, I've done the wrong thing here.
Yeah.
Which I can relate to that.
I saw your eyes wander back in memories of your mind just then.
It's just going through the filing cabinet of all the times I've done something silly like that. And the stakes are high in those moments because the volume of people we're interacting with. Now, that's not to say it's not just as important in the one-on-ones, but I think if we go back to the skydiving analogy, the stakes are very high of stuffing that up. Like the impact is very high. So life and death. Mm. In your teams, I'd love to know, what things do you feel like you would say are like really high stakes? We need to get these things right on our teams in order to make sure that we build that level of trust. Like, are there things that you're like, you would prioritize as being like, hey, this is something we all need to know?
It's a good call out, because I think one of the things I was thinking through in this whole conversation is we talk about how we should default to trust, which is that we should give people a base level of trust, but it's trust within boundaries, right? So if I employ somebody to work as an accountant for my business, I'm going to give them accountability to be able to access our bank accounts because I trust that that's what I've employed them to do. But I'm not going to give them full access to our bank accounts without external sign-off. And it's not saying I don't trust you. It's actually saying it's trust within boundaries. So I think all this is important to say, yes, give people a level of trust, but that trust also should be within the kind of context and boundaries. So I think one of the things that the research found about trust was we assume that the things that build trust are those very human qualities. Things like, you know, tell stories, you know, tell them about your personal life, ask them about their weekend. Turns out that was the category of things which was the least likely to build trust in teams. So this is what the research found, the things that build trust. Number one, be dependable.
Mm.
Meaning that if you say you'll do something, do it. Which is, you know, if you say, hey, let's do a one-on-one, it's showing up on time to the one-on-one. The second thing was be honest. Again, people wanted to feel like they could actually connect with you and that what you were saying was actually true. Third was actively listen, not just be silent while other people talk, don't just wait to respond, but actually help people feel seen, heard, and valued. Give helpful feedback was one of the kind of criteria for building trust. Modeling behaviors and leading by example, and then caring about employee well-being. These were the characteristics that helped build trust on the team according to 4,000 employees.
And it's amazing to think about the impact of, like I think about the feedback one and I know in environments, so I worked with a manager and he was so amazing and he was just known in the business for just being a straight shooter. Like people would call him that. They're like, he's a straight shooter. He'll tell it how it is.
Yeah.
But he's probably the most highly trusted person in that business because everyone knew it. They stood with him all the time because he was so honest, but he was kind. He, like, you could tell he really cared about people, like so genuinely cared about other people's success. But anytime there was an issue, he'd be the one coming up saying, look, how do you feel that went? Because I've got some feedback, but I just want to know first from you.
And you're like, okay,
okay, here we go. But I don't know, like that for me was such a like deep trusting relationship because I just felt like, okay, I know where I stand.
Yeah.
And he'll give me really positive feedback and really constructive feedback. Doesn't hold back. Sometimes I'll be like, oh, that hurts a bit. But I know it's coming from a place of like, I care about your success.
Yeah.
And for me, that predictability, he was so predictable. Like I could predict when he was going to cut. Like, it was all so predictable, but it was just such a like high trust relationship. And I think it had the combination, Shane, of like high trust and high accountability.
Yeah.
And I think that's where, to your point of like trust within boundaries, I think about how do we have the tension between high trust and high accountability?
Mm.
So we've got those parameters that we live in the kind of tension between those two things, because if we just have all accountability and no trust, well, that feels like control.
Yeah.
And if we just have like full trust without, hey, I'm going to have conversations with you when I feel like you didn't deliver, then that to me feels like we have all the safety in the world, but we're not required to kind of step up and grow when we need to. So how do you live in the kind of tension of those two dynamics?
Which I think the word is tension, right? I don't think it's going to be a constant pull between we've gone too far this way or we've gone too far that way. Like you'll see if you are in a high accountability culture where every single person is criticized or critiqued for the things that they do, people walk around feeling almost like a lack of morale or feel like they can't get anything right. On the flip side, if you're constantly saying, you know, you're great, you've got this, have full autonomy, and there's no pressure or no kind of tension on the rope, then people just go, oh, it's fine, I can just like cruise. And it actually doesn't do them any favors because they don't get better as a result. Because this is the thing, feedback makes us better. And I mean, I don't know why and how this keeps happening to you, but it feels like I'm constantly seeing on your stories that you're walking everywhere with your shirts inside out. And I'm wondering if it's now becoming a habit for you. But I've seen the way you talk about strangers who've given you that hard truth. And you see them as like, it's almost like they were a stranger, but they become a friend very quickly, right? Because they were a friend to you.
Well, they told me something that I'm like, oh gee, I'm so glad you've told me that I didn't get to where I was going.
Yeah.
And like have my shirt on inside out, which yes, that has happened.
That like fast track stranger to friend very quickly.
Like,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I'm like, I trust you with my life. Like, let's go skydiving.
Let's go.
Like,
I'll strap you to my back. Let's go skydiving together.
Oh my gosh. I've got the giggles. I just want to round out this conversation because I think this has like been so deep and so many people are going to relate to this. And I'll make an ask. If you feel like you're on a team right now that has some of these trust issues or that needs to do some work around living in the tension between accountability and trust, share this with a couple of people on your team. Share this with your boss. Get it out there because both Shane and I, this is the work we do every day with teams. You all over the world, me all around Australia. And we would love to be able to help you grow in this area on your team. We're about to go to a quick break. And when we come back, Shane, I really wanted to dig into this idea of psychological safety. If you want to grow in your career, I just wanted to remind you about our book, Sort Your Career Out and Make More Money. Glenn James and I have written this book to help you with any kind of career crisis, but also those things that you want, like getting a promotion, making more money, moving into a leadership role, or if it's time to quit your job. You can find our book wherever you get good books from, or you can listen on the audiobook, Sort Your Career Out and Make More Money. Now let's get back to the show.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I just want to ask one final question. You made a really good point around speed and safety. So speed and psychological safety. So how can we have this high-performing, high-paced team and still have the level of psychological safety? What do you reckon that looks like? How do we have both of those things?
Psychological safety is this like buzzword that kind of gets thrown around all the time. Everyone talks about Amy Edmondson, and for people, and it's important to know because we're in the world of psychological safety, we hear it all the time. But for some people, they may not even know what that is or what that even means on a team. And a lot of it came out of Amy Edmondson's work, where she studied teams in hospitals, and she wanted to find out if the most cohesive teams made more or less mistakes. Well, basically, she made the assumption that the more cohesive the team, the less mistakes they make. Turns out the teams that were the most cohesive in the hospitals were the teams that reported making the most mistakes. And as they dug deeper into it, what they learned is it wasn't that the more cohesive team made more mistakes, is that they were more honest about the mistakes that they made. And because they were more honest and open about those mistakes, they were more cohesive as a team. And so she kind of coined this term of psychological safety, which is this idea that you can show up in the workplace without the fear of harm or judgment or it being held against you. And so if you think about something like physical safety, to feel physically safe in the workplace means you're not worried about potential harm to you. And it's the same in a psychological way, that you could be in a team meeting and feel completely confident to show up as yourself without that threat of harm or punishment to you. And so it is literally the number one thing. We asked people, how could you identify a healthy culture in our research? And 62% said psychological safety. That's how they identify healthy culture, the number one reason. So it's a fundamental in building a team.
I think one of the fallacies around psychological safety is that psychological safety, and Don Price actually said this on a previous podcast episode, and I'm going to butcher his quote because he did it way better than me, but he said, we sometimes think psychological safety is the idea that we're all nice,
yeah,
and it's all cushy and lovely. And he's like, no, but the most psychologically safe teams are some of the most vocal teams, and they can have really open disagreement, but they do it in a way that's kind of infused with kindness. It's to get the best outcome, and it's not a team where conflict goes underground. So conflict comes up, like you're saying, with her research that hospitals were reporting more errors. So they're actually, the issues come to the surface more quickly. But the thing that I reckon with speed is because those issues come up more quickly and without the judgment and punishment and fear around them, you learn quicker as a result. So you're able to fail fast and move forward and like get progress a lot more quickly than organizations that are unpsychologically safe, psychologically unsafe, where the conflict goes underground and they can't make progress because they can't address those issues because they're not being spoken about.
Yeah. Oh gosh, this is something I've been talking to a lot of people about lately, and let me stand on a soapbox for a second, because I think this is I see this in so many contexts all the time, which is that in organizations that are not psychologically safe, solvable issues get buried and become catastrophic issues down the track because they weren't addressed yet. Most of our mistakes and errors or issues are often solvable at a certain point, and because of a lack of psychological safety or potentially a lack of accountability, a lack of systems, process, whatever it is down here, we don't know how to handle it. And so do all the things you say. We bury it, we ignore it, we try to put it away. And all of a sudden, it will eventually come to the surface, but it comes to the surface in a much more catastrophic way. And so, for example, you look at, I mean, I don't know the exact story of it, but look at the NASA launches and things like that. Or you know,
Boeing.
The Boeing example. Yeah, tell me, I don't know that fully.
Yeah, the Boeing example. We talk about this in our workshops actually and play a terrifying video.
Oh gosh.
You would hate it.
I would hate it. I hate flying.
I hate flying too. And I was—
Stop showing the video then.
So Boeing had, I guess the story is the downfall of Boeing, I think it's called on Netflix. Anyway, essentially it's about how they were competing with Airbus and the speed with which they needed to compete because Airbus was taking market share meant that they had to like rush through the builds, and there's the MCAS system is what it was called. Mm. And they skipped out on some of the testing. This is my like abridged version. Yeah. And essentially the technology wasn't tested properly, and the safety side, like the physical safety of like the builds of new planes wasn't done as well as it should have been. And they had two major, like absolutely devastating, tragic crashes over a period of, I don't know if it was like 18 months, can't remember the exact dates, but very, very short succession, unheard of in that industry. Yeah.
Aviation is such a safe, secure industry. Yeah.
And so what came out afterwards was this lack of psychological safety. This idea that people who were working, the engineers, were like trying to raise concerns, but their voice wasn't heard. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's like exactly what you're saying, that a solvable problem of, hey, we need to make sure that we're testing this new technology before we just go and implement it. It just means that, yes, catastrophic, like, you know, hundreds of lives lost because of that failure to have a high trust environment. And so I think to me, that's an example that speaks to your point of when we don't have high trust on teams, when we're not able to speak up without fear of punishment, the catastrophic impacts do come. They might not come immediately, but over time we start to see that play out. And that's a awful example of what I would say is a lack of psychological safety.
Yeah. I think the faster you can surface solvable problems, the less likely you are to deal with catastrophic consequences.
And I think all of this, so this week we got really heavy really
got
quick.
Got really heavy real quick.
One of the things that I would recommend for anyone listening is, if you want to build trust on your team and you think, okay, this relates to me, I want to build trust, whether you're a leader, whether you're a team member, whether you're an individual contributor, whatever part of the organization that you're in, I believe, and I know you do, Shane, that every person is responsible for building trust. Mm. Like, it's not just the manager's job. Yeah. It's every single person on a team gets to either contribute to or detract from trust. Mm. So I want you to start to think about, how might I be adding or taking away from trust on this team? And what could I do differently? How could I show up with what you described of dependability, being able to speak up, giving healthy, honest feedback? And if you want to know more, I'd love it, like, connect with us on LinkedIn. I know, Shane, you're doing some awesome stuff with like posting about this idea of how we build team cultures and really healthy cultures. And that to me is the deep work that needs to happen on teams across Australia. So if you want to know more about this, I want you to reach out to Shane on LinkedIn, connect with us. Any final remarks on this idea of trust before we close out so we don't finish on the morbid note?
Yeah. No, I think it's always interesting to talk about trust in the environment of like, how does my leader create a more trustworthy environment? How do I build better trust amongst my team? I think sometimes we start with the internal question of ourselves. It's like, what does it look to be trustworthy? And I love that kind of trustworthy, if you kind of take it and separate it apart. What does it look like to be worthy of trust? Which is, what would be the things that I need to do that would allow another person to feel safe with me, to put their trust in me, and continue to maintain that credibility over time? And you'll find that trust is a consequence of a lot of the decisions that we make, as opposed to pursuing trust. We pursue credibility, we pursue the habits, all the things we talked about in this podcast episode. And I think you can be worthy of trust. And I think that's a better place to start.
Love it. Hey, well, as always, thanks for hanging out. If you enjoyed the episode, give us a 5-star rating on Spotify and Apple and share this with someone who needs to hear it. Shane, how can people find out more about you?
Well, I just gave you a 6-star review on Apple Podcasts while we were doing this interview because it was so good. I had to draw it on my screen, but that's okay. Let's hang out on LinkedIn. That's where I hang out. It's the most fun. I'm most professional there.
Amazing. Well, hey, thanks for hanging out, Shane. See ya.
See ya.
We acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands on which we live and work and pay respects to their elders past, present and emerging. We extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who may listen to this podcast.
Before you do anything meaningful with your money, you need to be able to control your money. I can help. The Glen James Spending Plan is a complete spending plan budgeting system that will show you how to manage your money. It includes a downloadable spreadsheet that will tell you how much to put into what account each week, and you will get control over your money within 2 pay cycles. Thousands of people have used the Glen James Spending Plan and it is now free. So download the Glen James Spending Plan and enroll today.